Welcome to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Anna Page. And we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West.
The award-winning film, The Miseducation of Cameron Post, is based on the novel by the same name by former Miles City resident Emily Danforth.
The film takes place at a conversion therapy camp for gay youth. During the movie's Montana premiere, Matthew Shuka from the organization Born Perfect discussed his goal to raise awareness and increase public education on the dangers of conversion therapy.
Emily Danforth and Matthew Shuka join us in the studio to discuss how a powerful film and novel have the potential to change the hearts and minds of audiences. Emily, my first question has a lot to do with your book.
Okay.
I know that the movie is getting a lot of attention, but for the people that haven't read the book, that are seeing the movie, I want to steer them back to the book because the opening sentence of your novel is one of the most compelling that I had ever read.
Thank you.
The afternoon my parents died, I was out shoplifting with Irene Clausen. Mm-hmm. So that sets Cameron Post in a very unusual predicament. Mm. How did you decide her story, and where did that go from there?
I had to fight for that sentence, not with my editor so much, but I workshop parts of this novel, and people were constantly trying to get me to change that because they felt like it revealed too much in the first sentence and that it should be a surprise that the parents died, essentially. And I was like, the first chapter is not really about that part being a surprise. It's about the other things that are going on with her friend being the real conflict for her, in tandem, obviously, with her parents dying. So that was something that I got a lot of advice often, actually, from people, that you should change that first sentence. And I'm glad that I stuck with it. A big part of Cam's coming of age and a big part of what she's dealing with in this novel is this guilt she feels, essentially conflating different events in her life, right? And it's these attractions she's having for her friend, Irene. She's 12. That she doesn't fully understand but knows are romantic and somewhat sexual. And then these other sorts of adolescent behaviors that she's you know, being a part of, like shoplifting, obviously. And the fact that all of this sort of comes together one summer day that happens to be the day her parents die becomes a big part of what she's trying to figure out as she both recognizes her queerness, but also mourns her parents. So it becomes, you know, it's essentially the thing that's fueling a lot of her coming of age, is sort of reconciling the guilt she feels over having paired those two moments. Once I found that sentence, I knew that I had her voice, I think. I knew the way she was going to tell the story.
Let's talk a little bit about growing up in Miles City. What was it like for you?
Sure. It was quite a lot. Like, what I usually say is that Cam's emotional landscape and her emotional terrain feel very much like they were pulled right from my own life. I think that a lot of the guilt Cam feels, a lot of the shame that she feels, a lot of the crushes that she has, those kinds of, that emotional terrain is very much my experience. And I also, you know, sort of stole locations from my life in Miles City, from the mini mart to the video store. I mean, all of those places are places that I visited in the 80s and 90s growing up there, closeted.
When you decided to write a novel, I mean, was an autobiography ever on your mind, or did you really want to write a novel of the young adult genre?
Yeah, I think coming of age novels are the novels I cut my teeth on. You know, I've read hundreds in my life. The American coming of age novel is sort of that's my wheelhouse. And I couldn't imagine that my first novel would be anything but that. And I knew that I wanted it to be queer. I mean, I wanted it to be expressly queer. So I loved sentimental women's novels, like novels of instruction, like The Wide, Wide World. But I wanted to write an explicitly queer version of that book, not a subtextually queer version. So, yeah, I never thought of writing a memoir. It was always going to be a coming-of-age novel.
I thought it was interesting. There was a press blurb that said if Holden Caulfield had been a gay girl in Montana, this is the story he might have told.
Mm-hmm. I thought that was remarkable because so many of the details of Holden's adolescence don't look at anything like mine, right?
No, but, and yeah. Holden was so whiny.
Yeah.
And Cameron Post, she's out there. I mean, she has guilt about
Certainly.
Her emotions, but she's kind of a wild character.
Yeah. I was asked recently to give a percentage, like how much of you is in Cam, and I think I settled at 72% or something, you know. But I think Cam is braver as a character than I was as a teen. I think that what you're calling out there, some of the things she's willing to say and some of the actions she takes are a bit braver than who I was in high school.
You've described this as a novel of place.
Yeah.
How did Montana shape you as a writer, and does it still?
I mean, it shaped me in all ways as a writer. One, just because of the literary traditions in Montana that I became aware of very early, either from novels I read, like A River Runs Through It. I read A River Runs Through It very early, maybe 7th, 8th grade, and was like stunned that someone who lived in Montana produced that book. I mean, I just remember like it was a really powerful moment, and was also aware of the University of Montana and the legacy of the writing program there pretty early before I ever had a sense that I would get an MFA or really what an MFA was. Just that, oh, you know, writers live in Montana and make their art in Montana. But I also think I grew up in a house where storytelling was really valued, and I think of Miles City as a place where there are a lot of really great sort of storytellers at the Corner Cafe, you know, and people tell their stories well and are proud to tell their stories. So I think that certainly affected me too, this sense that people take the time and value, I think, hearing each other's stories.
Emily, I went to your reading in Miles City when the book first came out.
I remember that.
And it was so much fun. One, I was really glad that your mother didn't die in a car wreck. And what
to
a
learn
delight
that fact.
She was.
Yes, yes.
And that the entire city of Miles City came to your reading.
Oh, I don't know about that.
You weren't exactly a black sheep in the community.
No, I don't. No, people have been very supportive, much to my surprise. People have been really supportive of the book and of me. And in fact, one of my favorite responses ever was a high school classmate who knew vaguely what some of the topics of the book were. And she said, when I got this book, I braced myself, sort of opening it, and was really worried about how you would portray us and how we would come off. And I was surprised to find all the love on the page for Miles City, that she wasn't expecting that. And I think there is a lot of love for Miles City in the book. I think some of it is just hometown pride. I think that they're just proud that I made this book. I'm not always sure if they love the book or what the book is about, but I know that people are happy that I wrote it.
The movie is very interesting because it's really a section of the book. Mm-hmm. And I, because I'm from Montana, my favorite part was, of course, in Miles City, growing up in the hospital, the swimming pool, yeah, the video store. How did you feel about the movie being made and taking a section of the movie, or section of the book, and making it into a movie?
I think there are a lot of directors who could have approached me with that concept, and I would have been really worried about how they would have handled that. And I still had to acclimate to it, even when Desiree Akhavan, I think the brilliant director of the film, approached me. And I should say that from the outset, before they optioned the book, this was the first conversation that we had. This was always her plan. I knew that she'd known the book for a long time. She'd recommended the book to people years before she was able to actually have the resources to option it. But this was always her plan. So it was something that I knew from the ground floor level and that we discussed. But because Desi is queer, she's a woman director, because I knew she was a fan of the book and didn't just see it as some sort of controversial thing she could sell, and because I knew her previous work, I was a big fan of her web series, I was a big fan of her first film, for all of those reasons, I felt really comfortable trusting her to do this in a way that I think there are other people who could have approached me and I would have said, I don't know. I still really wanted them to film in Montana, and I think Desi really wanted to film in Montana, and the film, they just did not have, this film was made on like a micro budget, and I think it was really smart, actually, that they didn't try to fake Montana or cheat Montana to say in the film that, you know, the film is in Montana, when obviously the locations wouldn't look that way or feel that way to Montanans. But I was still really hoping right up until the time that they kind of went to set that they might be able to film something here, and they just couldn't make it work. So
now the film has been received very well, and it took home the prestigious Grand Jury Prize at the 2018 Sundance Film Festival. What are you feeling after it's been released, and what was it like working with the film's director?
Both Desiree Akhavan and her writing, the woman who co-wrote the script and produced the film, Cecilia Frugiuele, have been amazing. It's been, I think I've had kind of a dream experience that maybe is not the experience of lots of novelists who have their books adapted. We Skyped and met and emailed early on in the process. I saw several drafts of the screenplay. I gave them notes. They certainly took some of those and rejected others. Certainly, I think I gave them 7 pages of notes, and they were like, "That's thank you for all those notes. Calm down." But they really included me, and I went to set a couple of times. I went to set with my wife. We're in the movie very, very briefly in the rock concert scene. If you blink, you'll miss us, but we're in it. So it's been a joy, and I love the film. I mean, I think ultimately, it's the kind of film that would have changed my life as a closeted 13-year-old in Eastern Montana, if I'd been able to find it. If I'd found it on the shelf of the video store and brought it home secretly, I would have watched it over and over again and possibly stolen it, frankly, so I didn't have to return it and I could kind of keep it and keep watching it.
Well, let's get into the film a little bit.
Sure.
The film is really about a young woman who's sent to a gay conversion camp. And the odd thing, when I was watching the film, I thought, well, they're all gay. I mean, who thought that was a good idea if you're trying to convert people that really were isolated in the world mm-hmm. in their gayness, and then all of a sudden you're in a camp and, wait, there are people like me.
Yeah.
So I want to ask you that question.
Yeah.
And certainly, Matthew, having been through a conversion, what that was like and what you thought about the experience itself.
Hmm. I mean, I'll just say that, you know, I think one of the beautiful and maybe unexpected things in this film is that Cam and some of the other disciples, I put that in sort of scare quotes, disciples who are at God's Promise, do find their first sense of queer community, which certainly the people who are running the camp do not intend. But I, you know, I think one thing that I say all the time that some people, you know, friends that I have kind of find disbelieving, but it's true, I didn't know anyone who was out and queer until I got to college. You know, I did not know. Now, certainly there were queer people in my town, of course, but I didn't know anyone growing up, right, who was out and queer until I got to college on the East Coast. And even then, it took a little while. And so I think it's like a revolutionary moment for Cam and some of the other characters that they find these people. And even though they're being there, right, they're there specifically to be deprogrammed, essentially, right, to be brainwashed. They still find their first sense of queer community. And it's really empowering, actually. It's a very empowering thing for Cam, certainly, but a couple of the other characters as well. So
I was in conversion therapy for 5 years. I met hundreds to maybe close to 1,000 other teenagers at that time going through the same thing I was going through. And I do have friends till this day that I met in conversion therapy, and I love them, and we have something that we bond over, an experience. But I think at the time, I just felt more like we were a group of people who were ashamed of ourselves.
Mm.
Yes, that may have been the first interaction, and it was exciting to talk to. It was definitely exciting to talk to other queer kids. Most of my conversion therapy sessions or the one camp I went to was all gay men dealing with same-sex attraction, as they say, or SSA. Yeah, it was cool to talk about it, but we were like on a mission. We all really believed in the therapy and that we were gonna cure this illness that we all had. So it's bittersweet, I think. And I think I'm just more proud to be out and open and living my life today.
Now, Matthew, you do work as an anti-conversion therapy activist, and I'm curious, is gay conversion therapy still practiced? Is it regulated by individual states?
Yeah, so conversion therapy is just as prevalent as it was a decade ago or two decades ago. And that's scary, and I think the public doesn't really see it that way or just doesn't know. So we have our studies. Our studies show, you know, our most recent one is with UCLA, which released their findings in this past January, and the numbers show that 700,000 people in the United States have been through conversion therapy, and somewhere between 57,000 and 77,000 teenagers will go through it in the next 5 years. Each state has their own laws, and that's what we've created when I co-founded the Born Perfect campaign with the National Center for Lesbian Rights, and we introduced bills state by state. So far, 14 states have passed legislation which outlaw a licensed professional from treating minors, so anyone under the age of 18. I can say that we've been really successful. It's pretty amazing. We've passed about 60 pieces of legislation. So we have the 14 states and about 45 or so cities or municipalities nationwide have passed similar bills, and they're specifically in states that don't have protections.
I think it's interesting that they're mostly run by religious groups. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? And I guess I have the same problem when I think about Alcohol Anonymous, is that if you're an alcoholic, does having a religion make you not drink? I guess I never made the connection between church and sexuality or church and alcohol. And I know, Emily, you were raised in a very, I wouldn't say, not a fundamental, a Lutheran family, mm-hmm. but the community had a real religious sensibility about
it.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Do you both want to comment about how that church plays into the story?
It's a great question. Yes, religious figures and licensed professionals are doing this work. I grew up in a Jewish home, and I grew up in a conservative town, a conservative home. But my parents didn't really want to hear a rabbi or a pastor tell them that they can make this go away. In a weird way, they did their due diligence and were like, let's talk to a professional. Let's really find out that there's results to this. And my 5 years of conversion therapy was conducted by licensed professionals. Now, I did encounter Christianity, Mormon, and Jewish therapists and would want to use that, and I was open to it. But I guess, even though I was conservative, they wanted to, and religious to a certain degree, they wanted to know that there was actually something backing this, and not it just be only pray away the gay.
Yeah, and I think I would just say that maybe different than other queer teens who do grow up in fundamentalist households. I didn't receive a lot, as Corby, as you said, a lot of the messages, negative messages or disparaging messages about queerness or homosexuality in my house, although it certainly was not discussed in my house. And if it was discussed, it would probably be in a disparaging way. There was just really silence around it, right? It was as if it didn't exist. But I did from my peers. I mean, my peer group, absolutely, eighth grade, ninth grade, right as I'm figuring out, okay, for sure, I like girls. There's no question. The people that I surrounded myself and chose to surround myself with were quite vocal about their feelings about gay people. So it wasn't in my house, but it did feel like it was in my peer group and in my broader community. And I think, you know, I've said before, and this is something that it took me a while to figure out. I think I sort of pushed myself into being friends with some of those people as a way to keep hiding. It was kind of like, I don't feel safe coming out. I don't think it would be well received. And so I will make sure that I'm friends with people who I know would have a problem with it.
I'm curious about the research that was involved in writing this novel. A lot of it is autobiographical, or at least comes from and is informed by your experiences mm-hmm. growing up in Miles City, with the exception of the conversion therapy treatment. So yeah. Did you spend a lot of time maybe in these camps or just researching to get a feeling for how you would portray that?
Yeah, I certainly never went to conversion therapy. But what I was looking at it, I think Matthew spoke well to it, obviously, and can speak very effectively because he has 5 years of a range of experience. But one of the things that was very sort of eye-opening for me as I began to research conversion therapy is that I had a single story of it in my head, and there is not, to quote Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, there is not a single story of conversion therapy. It can look like a lot of things, and there are maybe some more common narratives than others, but that was one thing that was sort of surprising to me. I also was very much looking at it through the lens of the early 90s. I received a lot of the materials that I received were from Exodus International, which has since disbanded, but that was one of the focal points where I was, got on their mailing list for a long time, and so I was actually looking at worksheets and study guides that would have been given to religious and other officials who were trying to implement these kinds of programs, maybe in their churches. I read Mel White's Stranger at the Gate, which is a really powerful memoir from someone who was fairly high up in terms of evangelical politics in this country, who was going through his own kind of conversion therapy. So I talked to some survivors as well. So it took a variety of forms, my research. But I think, again, I was really trying to look at it through the lens of a particular time and place, right? And not, I was writing the book in like 2005. I wasn't necessarily looking at what was going on around me in the world of conversion therapy then.
I had a friend that was sent to gay conversion camp, and he's 25 years younger than I am. Mm. And he was like, yippee, gay camp. Mm. I mean, he's a very religious person. Mm. And going to the camp, he never thought he would be straight. Mm. And now he's a very gay, very religious Lutheran person. Mm. So I'm just wondering, that's 30 years of time that has gone by. And I'm wondering right now, I noticed in the paper there was a camp in Big Timber that is for LGBT youth in Big Timber, Montana. Mm. Has times changed? I mean, Matthew, what do you think?
We're talking about like openly gay camps, not conversion therapy camps.
No, he was at a conversion therapy camp, but he saw it as, oh boy, there's going to be a lot of gay people there. I mean, he looked forward to it.
But then the camp you just referenced is an actual camp for LGBTQ
yeah.
teens.
Okay.
So a different thing entirely. But you had something you wanted to say, I think, earlier.
I was just going to say, it's pretty crazy because you were writing the book in 2005. Mm-hmm. I was in conversion therapy from 2004 to 2009. Mm. And I think knowing the book, seeing the film, having worked on the film, it's like so scary how real it is. And it's like, crazy. And you know, we had never met until the movie. I was asked by, you know, Desiree, I guess, introduced us. Mm-hmm. But it might as well, you know, the movie takes place in 1993 as does the book, and it might as well be 2018. It's not really any different. And I think what's so eloquent about Emily is, for example, you know, when you see the movie or if you've read the book, the icebergs and the iceberg exercise. And no one had ever called it the iceberg exercise in my conversion therapy, but it is literally what you do, which is find out what caused your homosexuality. And you're mentally going down this rabbit hole of trying to find what caused you to be the sick. And Emily was just able to put that into a story that I haven't seen before. And, you know, it was being a survivor, just it touched me in a way. And since seeing it on film was like, because conversion therapy is one of the hardest things to capture in film. And I think what Emily was able to put in a book that was then Desiree to create for film was remarkable. And I think that's what makes it such, it's no surprise that it won the Grand Jury Prize. And Emily was a huge part of that.
Oh, thank you, Matthew. It means a lot. I mean, you want to feel like you got at least one part of the story right, or that someone who is a survivor and can speak to it feels like, yeah, that was my experience. I mean, I think as a fiction writer, it's an incredible compliment.
Emily, I wonder if you would read a passage from the book.
I will. I'm going to, just to set this up a little bit, this is early on in the novel. As Corby shared, Cam's parents die in the very first sentence of the book, or you know that they die. So this is in the aftermath of that. Irene and I hadn't seen each other much since our robot hug at my parents' funeral in June. Mrs. Clausen kept trying to arrange sleepovers and day trips to the mall in Billings, to a rodeo in Glendive, but I would back out at the last minute. "We understand, sweetheart," Mrs. Clausen would tell me over the phone. I guess the "we" she was speaking of included Irene, but maybe she meant Mr. Clausen. "We're not going to stop trying, though. Okay, Cam?" When, in late August, I had finally agreed to go with them to the Custer County Fair, I spent the whole evening wishing that I hadn't. Irene and I had done up the fair before. We'd done it up big. We'd buy the wristbands that let you ride all the rides you wanted. We'd eat graveyard snow cones, lime, orange, grape, cherry mixed together, and Paco's from the Crystal Pistol booth, seasoned beef in a cocoon of hot fry bread, the orange grease squirting and burning the insides of our cheeks. We'd wash everything down with lemonade from that stand with the wasps buzzing all around it, and then we'd make fun of the Blue Ribbon craft projects and dance a wild jitterbug to whatever lame-o band they'd brought in. In years before, we thought we owned the fair. But that August, we haunted the Midway like ghosts, stopping in front of the Tilt-A-Whirl, then the fishbowl game, watching like we'd already seen everything there was to see but couldn't quite pull ourselves away. We didn't talk about my parents, the accident. We didn't say much of anything at all. Everything was painted in ringing noises and flashing lights and shouting and screaming, crazy laughter, little kids crying, the smell of popcorn and fry bread and cotton candy thick in the air, but it all just sort of floated around me like smoke. Irene bought us tickets for the Ferris wheel, a ride we deemed too boring the year before, but it seemed like we should be doing something. We sat in that metal car, our bare knees just touching. Even when we'd jerk them apart, they'd wind up magnetized again some moments later. We were closer together than we had been since the night her father knocked on her bedroom door. We were lifted up into the hot embrace of the ever-blackening Montana sky, the lights from the Midway sluicing us in their fluorescent glow, a tinny kind of ragtime music plinking out from somewhere deep in the center of the wheel. Up on top, we could see the whole of the fair, the tractor pull, the dance pavilion, cowboys and wranglers leaning cowgirls built like sticks of gum up against pickups out in the parking lot. Up on top, the air smelled less like grease and sugar, more like just baled hay and the muddy waters of the Yellowstone as it lazed its way around the fairgrounds. Up on top, it was quiet. Everything squashed down below us. The loudest noise, the squeak of the bolts as the wind shifted our car just so. And then we had to float back down into all of it. The whole Midway pressed up against us. And I held my breath until we were back on top again. Our third time up there, Irene grabbed my hand. We stayed like that for one full rotation, saying nothing, fingers wound together. And for that 40 seconds or so, I pretended like things were just as they always were. Me and Irene at the fair. When we got back to the top again, Irene was crying, and she said, "I'm really sorry, Cam. I'm sorry. I don't know what else to say." Irene's face was bright against the dark of the sky, her eyes all shimmery wet, pieces of her hair blown free from her ponytail. She was beautiful. Everything in me wanted to kiss her, and at the same time, it felt like everything in me was sick. I pulled my hand away from hers and looked out over my side of the car, dizzy with nausea. I closed my eyes to keep from throwing up, and even then I could taste it. I heard Irene next to me saying my name, but it sounded like she was saying it from beneath the pile of sand. They had stopped the ride to let people off and on down below. We shifted in the wind. We started up again, moved a few clicks, stopped. Now I wanted to be back on the midway and in the rush of all that noise. Irene was still crying beside me. "We can't be friends like we were before, Irene," I told her, keeping my eyes fixed on a couple all twined up in the parking lot. "Why?" she asked. The ride started up again. Our car jerked and we were lowered a few clicks. We stopped. Now we hovered half in the sky and half in the midway, level with the bright canvas tops of the game booths. I didn't say anything. I let the music plink. I remember the feel of her mouth that day in the hayloft, the taste of her gum and the root beer we'd been drinking, the day she dared me to kiss her. And the very next day, my parents' car had veered through the guardrail. I didn't say anything. If Irene hadn't connected those dots herself, then it wasn't my place to do it for her, to explain that everybody knows how things happen for a reason, and that we had made a reason, and bad, bad, unthinkable things had happened.
That is so beautiful because the character is very much in love with the woman she's sitting next to, the young girl, yeah. But she is convinced that she can't do that.
No, Emily, you're teaching out at Rhode Island College.
I am.
And I'm curious, what is your next literary project? Are you working on something?
Well, I'm clearly a slow novelist, and I've had to burn a couple of books down to the ground to get to the book that I have now. But it's finished, and my agent actually has it and is taking it out. It will not be a young adult novel. It will be an adult novel. Its title is Plain Bad Heroines, and the connection to that is Mary MacLaine. I Await the Devil's Coming, and I insist on calling it I Await the Devil's Coming, which is what Mary wanted it titled, not the story of Mary MacLaine. 19-year-old Mary MacLaine from Butte, Montana, her sensational memoir, she has a great line in it about why won't anyone write a book about a plain bad heroine? Why do we have all these blushing, charming, wide-eyed heroines who, you know, and so... my book takes place, half of it is historic, and it takes place in 1902 at a cursed boarding school in Rhode Island where the girls are, as many girls in this country were, obsessed with that book and feel very sort of emboldened by the things that Mary MacLaine says on the page, including her romantic attraction to her teacher, Fanny Corbin, who she lived with briefly. And then half of the book is actually about the women who are making a film, the contemporary half of the book, of that story, of that cursed boarding school. So it's very queer and kind of gothic and a ghost story and was a lot of fun to write. So I hope that I have some publication info about that soon.
Oh, fantastic.
Thank you.
We'll look forward to getting our hands on it.
Thank you so much.
And we thank you both, Emily Danforth and Matthew Shirka. Thank you so much for being in the studio today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains is produced by Corby Skinner, Anna Page, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Naumann. Additional funding provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. More information on Resounds is available at ypradio.org.